This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the spread of conspiracy theories around the 2020 election. If you have questions or comments on our show today, we are live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we will do our best to get it in front of our guests today. You can also leave us a voicemail so we can hear your voice in the program today. Call us at 866-476-3881. And when you do that, we just need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation. 866-476-3881, or send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We are joined now by Jim Shanahan. He's the co-author of the study that we're talking about today and the dean of the media school at Indiana University. Jim Shanahan, welcome.
Hi, Matt. How you doing?
Doing okay. Glad to have you. So can you tell us about this study that you've been working on?
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. This is a study that comes out of a research group that we're part of here called the Observatory on Social Media, which is a collaboration between the Media School and our partners in the Luddy School, which focuses on informatics and computer technology. And so we have a collaboration where we look at what's happening in social media from a technical standpoint, and we can look at various characteristics of things that are being posted for whether they're coming from humans or from bots or coordinated attacks, that kind of thing. And in this project, we merge that with expertise on communication and media study and journalism as well. So that's the overall goal of the project. For this study, we thought that, you know, these narratives, conspiracy theory narratives, not all of them are conspiracy theories, but all of them have degrees of untruth or aren't well supported, that they were so prevalent in the election that we decided we wanted to track them through the election. So we began gathering data on this in August, around mid-August, and we put several waves of a study into the field. We just, in fact, finished up the fifth wave of this study. So the very basics of the study are that we asked in a survey, we asked our respondents, we showed them screenshots from social media that relate to the various narratives that we'll get into here, and asked them, have you seen that or not? Do you think you've seen that? And they say, yes, no, maybe. And then later in the survey, we asked, do you believe the gist of this narrative? And so we have data about exposure to such narratives and data about beliefs in such narratives as well. And, you know, for us in the media school, we're interested in then the relationship of that to which social media platforms they use, mass media platforms, those kinds of things, as well as to presidential preference. So those are the basics of the study. There's a lot of details that we get into.
I mean, you focus on what you call factually unsupported narratives, but I think some people might just call them conspiracy theories. Are they the same thing?
You know, I think there are some differences. When you really get into trying to write a survey question, you know, we started out by just saying we're going to present false narratives. What you end up, though, and when you look at the fact checking on most of these narratives, there are degrees of differences. So some things are statements that just have no real evidence for them. And, you know, you could suppose that, well, they might be supported at some point in the future, but as of now, there's no evidence for them. Others really do fall into the kind of classic conspiracies you mentioned, QAnon in your intro, and things like that. So there is a range of them that I think it's important to recognize that nuance.
And you mentioned QAnon, but did you focus or did you include that in your study? What other narratives did you include?
Yeah, QAnon's in our study, and of course, QAnon played a very big played a prominent role in this election. It's perhaps a little bit early to say how much it actually moved votes one way or another. You mentioned some candidates who won election. Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance, you mentioned as somebody who had supported QAnon at some point. She kind of has tried to walk that back as well. There's a candidate in Colorado who also won election to a seat and has also walked back support for that. There's a lot of other candidates who were connected to QAnon at some point by sharing hashtags and doing things on social media. A lot of those lost, actually. So QAnon definitely played a role. So your original question was, did we include it? Yes, we have a couple of questions about QAnon. We found that it was a little bit of a difficult one to ask questions about because we were trying to assess people's belief in the actual narrative. And in one version of a question we asked, it turned out that people were responding more to the fact that, yeah, QAnon is out there and is a force in the election. So I think, you know, a year ago, very small percentages of people probably would have known what QAnon meant. Many, a much larger percentage now knows what that means. And that's the one that really falls into the classic conspiracy theory definition that you're looking for. It's not entirely new because it goes back to conspiracies that had been around in the previous election. Pizzagate would, you know, be kind of a precursor. And in fact, there's there's so many versions and things and threads happening in QAnon that it's impossible to keep track of it, of all of them. And there are roots in conspiracy theories that go even farther back. So it's a long, it's actually a long thread in American politics, much longer than we might realize if we think conspiracy theories are brand new in this election.
Let's back up on QAnon just a little bit in case listeners might not be familiar. Certainly a lot of us have heard QAnon, but can you explain what it is and what its believers believe, I suppose?
It could be harder than you think. And I've actually been teaching a course here at IU on conspiracy theories this semester. So I read up on it some more, and I went out and purchased some of the literature that would give you kind of the background on it. And it can be very, to the extent that it makes sense, Matt, you know, it can be hard to explain. The basic idea is that it's this theory that there is a conspiracy of people who may be satanic, they may be pedophiles. They're working to overthrow the vision that Donald Trump has of, you know, a free and just and fair society. Q refers to this supposed personage that is dropping clues or breadcrumbs onto the internet in various channels, places that most listeners probably don't inhabit on the internet, things like 4chan and, you know, some of the perhaps darker discussion channels and so forth, and leaving these clues and breadcrumbs, if you will, and literally predictions of things that were supposed to happen. And then people who are sort of the QAnon priesthood, you might call them, or the adepts, if you will, at decoding and deciphering these clues, you know, we'll talk about them on internet chat rooms and things like that. And it's just become an incredibly powerful galvanizing force for a certain part of the electorate who always, I think, harbored this idea that or fear, if you will, of government intrusion on personal liberties, you know, Second Amendment kinds of things. And for folks who harbor a really strong connection to the idea that personal liberty is the highest value amongst all.
So you mentioned some of the things that QAnon supporters believe, Satanism and pedophilia within the Democratic Party. Can you talk about some of the specific theories that were covered in the study? I guess I would imagine you covered those big two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say that QAnon was, in fact, not the major one that we looked at in the study.
What was?
I'll give you a sense to just back up. In our first wave, you know, our approach was, let's put out some narratives here in the first wave, which was back in August. So we're going back now 2.5 months. And let's see if we're correct about what we think people are resonating with. And we did that first simply by starting to look empirically at the narratives that we could harvest from the various social media feeds that we looked at. The two that kind of leapt out at the first and that we ended up tracking throughout the study were the idea that Joe Biden suffers from some type of cognitive disability, you know, that would impair his ability to be president. And then the second one was this narrative that mail-in ballots would cause systemic or widespread voter fraud. Mm. So you know, those were two out of the five that we looked at originally that were getting enough traction that we decided to track them throughout all the rest of the waves of study that we did.
Does it seem like those two are perhaps the most popular and seem to be the most legitimate among people who are, you know, looking at conspiracy theories with not so narrow an eye?
What do you mean by legitimate, Matt?
Well, I mean, they seem okay. So you're talking about Joe Biden's cognitive ability.
Right.
It's easy to point to that and say, look, he's losing his mind, whatever it might be. Or it's easy to repeat the narrative that the president himself has been putting out there, that mail-in voting is rife with fraud. It's a little harder when you get into, you know, I don't want to say normal people, but that's what's coming to mind right now, when you get into something like Democrats are Satanists and pedophiles.
Right.
So you see what I mean? One seems more believable to the other for a mainstream, I suppose.
Well, I see where you're going with that. And in fact, yeah, there are differences. I think let's take the Biden one, you know. So before we put that into our study as a narrative, we go back and, you know, we're well aware that that there are politicians out there who are promoting this narrative very openly. It takes it out of the realm of a normal conspiracy theory that might be more secret. But, you know, we make sure we look at our fact checking. There's no evidence whatsoever of a medical type or of any sort to show that Joe Biden has any kind of cognitive deficit whatsoever. It's well known that he has a stutter. He talks about that openly. That comes out sometimes in his speaking. And there's plenty of things you can see on the internet that are sort of doctored, if you will, video types of things to make him look that way. But so, you know, what we see with that narrative is, and a lot of these do, in fact, start with the president as the most effective spreader of them, if you will, that that one is over the waves that we tracked was getting traction at, and I'm just going from memory here now, but at about 45% of the folks that we surveyed. So just to be clear, you know, we ask people, do you believe this narrative is true? And people could say, I definitely think it's true, or I likely think that's true, or I likely think it's false, or definitely false.
Okay, so we'll be back right after a quick break. We are talking today about a study on the spread of 2020 election conspiracy theories on social media and its potential effect on people's voting. And we are with Jim Shanahan, one of the co-authors of that study. We will be back in 90 seconds with more. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about the findings of a recent study on the spread of conspiracy theories, including QAnon, surrounding the 2020 election on social media and how it might have affected voting this year. And we welcome your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, and we might just share it on the show. 866-476-3881 to leave a voicemail, or send us a high-quality voice message through our free smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send your question or comment, and we will try to get it into the show today. We are talking with Jim Shanahan, co-author of a recent study tracking theories around the 2020 election on social media. And Jim Shanahan, I mean, conspiracy theories often beget other conspiracy theories of, I guess, is how much crossover is there on the conspiracy theories that are gaining traction right now among the people who, I guess, believe them?
There's a lot. And there's been studies on this going back probably 20 or 30 years, which is the idea that if you believe one, you're more likely to believe another. And that theories often also sort of connect to each other into, I don't know, you might call them super theories, you know, mega meta theories, you know. So there is, I think, something that can happen with a conspiracist mindset, if you will, a psychology, that once you've sort of headed down that road on one thing, if, you know, that's the point of a conspiracy, is that they are big and they're sinister and we don't know about them. And so it's perhaps a little bit counterintuitive to think that I only believe in small conspiracies in a limited area. by definition, you've kind of accepted that they're now going to be interconnected. And, you know, we see that in our data, too. So if we look at people who are expressing belief on one in any given survey, we have five questions about separate theories that people are asked about. And there definitely is variance. So there are a significant number of folks who will, in any given survey, respond positively in terms of belief to all five of the questions that we ask. And then, of course, there's those who think they're all not true. There is some folks in the middle as well. But yeah, I think it's in the nature of a conspiracy, either an actual conspiracy or a conspiracy theory, to think that it grows and it sends its tentacles out. And there's something to that kind of narrative as well that's very compelling for many people.
You talked about what's going on in a person's brain when they're reading about or believing conspiracy theories. I mean, I'm sure that there is a spectrum where this is concerned, but is this just confirmation bias? Is it learned? Is there really something different about these people that will always make them susceptible to this? I don't know. How far into that did you look?
We've got actually some psychological measures in the study. And, you know, before I get into that, you know, there are a lot of different theories that social scientists are exploring about why we have this conspiracist mindset, why some people have this conspiracist mindset, if you will. A lot of interesting thoughts. For me, I think ultimately it comes down to the idea that, and you don't have to be a conspiracist to be in this camp, is that we are influenced by compelling narratives, you know? And sometimes what happens in reality, you know, if we take a very compelling event like 9/11, let's say, or, you know, something like that, a tremendously huge impact. And for some people, it's not sufficient to believe that this was really caused, you know, by 10 or 20 guys who did this, and that there must be something much more sinister and huge behind it, that the cause must match the magnitude of the effect. And I think if we step back from it and think about it, the reality is that sometimes really huge and big things happen by accident or randomly. And, you know, in the end, there may not be a conspiracy behind them. But we are very motivated, I believe, by the power of narrative. And so the conspiracy theory is never a boring narrative. That's the point of it. It's, oh my God, QAnon, look what's happening. These clues are being left for us. It's like a James Bond movie, and we can follow the clues and we can talk to each other about it. And I think that's a natural human tendency. It's not just people who believe in QAnon. I think we're all susceptible to looking for compelling narratives in many ways that aren't tinged by the conspiracist problem. But when we think about issues like, you know, with COVID, to stray away from the election a little bit there, that, you know, that's obviously an event of major magnitude. And, you know, the idea may be that it sort of happened like a random genetic mutation somewhere. Others can't accept that. And so conspiracy theories spring up to match the magnitude of the event with the magnitude of a cause. That's a natural breeding ground for kind of conspiracy, the current COVID crisis. It's a double, it's a perfect storm, if you will, combine that with the president that we have, the elections going on, which is why we're in sort of a golden age of conspiracy thinking, you might argue. But I think, you know, you asked about, you know, psychological tendencies. We've got a measure, for instance, in our study that looks at, we ask people to respond to a psychological measure about their open-mindedness versus how much they rely on principled thinking. That's the sort of title of this measure. And we found that open-minded people by that measure were less likely to express support for the conspiracy narratives that we presented. We've got some other ones in there. But, you know, Matt, I think there's still a lot of discussion and debate in social science about what really causes this psychologically. I think ultimately all those explanations will come together, as well as the time we're living in now, which seems to be an especially fertile ground for it.
We've been talking a lot about far-right conspiracy theories. What's coming from the far left?
Well, from the left, you know, I'd start by saying that historically, the phenomenon of conspiracism is more frequent on the right. If we go back through history and we look at, I don't know, McCarthyism, and we can go to conspiracies that have been leveled against ethnic groups, whether they're anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic, even far back into history, anti-Masonic, anti-Illuminati, you know, some terms that still ring around. There is often a phenomenon where a group that's more conservative is concerned, and eventually these can rise to the point of hysteria, about foreign influences that are coming in, strange actors, that eventually get spun up into even demonic things like what we see with QAnon and the Satanism thing. So it's not unusual that we see that. But we do know that we struggle a little bit more to find narratives that were emerging from the left, but we do have some. And we found that when we found those and put those in our survey, that people on the left, i.e. Democrats or supporters of Biden in this case, were more likely to support those than Republicans. The idea, for instance, that Trump faked COVID-19 to win support before the election, behaved ideologically consistently with left-leaning people as the other ones did with right-leaning people. Same thing about President Trump's stroke. So, but they are more frequent on the right. And the other thing right now, you know, keep in mind that we're looking at them in social media. And so, and not just President Trump, but others who are prolific spreaders of these kinds of things in their social media means that those narratives then do start to dominate. But I wouldn't by any means suggest that ideologically we are immune from these on one side or the other. And the ideology is part of it. So, you know, the more ideological, the more likely you are to be susceptible to the one that, and you mentioned confirmation bias earlier. And interestingly, as a final point, almost all of the narratives that we looked at, independents, self-identified independents, were in the middle, you know, which is kind of where you would expect them to be. So there's a very strong ideological component to these.
I know you've just simply conducted this study, but I guess I want to ask for a little bit of advice. I mean, we see this kind of thing a lot on social media, and depending on who you are and who your friends are, you might see more or less of it, I guess. So what should people do when they're exposed to these kinds of ideas?
Well, that's one of the $64,000 questions, I think.
I know. That's a little bit.
I would say, first of all, you know, we're from a policy perspective, we're dealing with this issue, and it's really important to think about it. So we're seeing, for instance, that social media platforms, there's a lot of pressure on them to label things or ban things from their platforms. And so you're seeing that in Twitter, in YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, where the platforms are complying with that to some extent under extreme pressure from certain parts of the political spectrum. You know, on the other side of that, you have the worry that do we really want, you know, Facebook, for instance, to be the one that determines what is viewed to be, you know, legitimate information versus something that would be called a conspiracy theory or an unsupported narrative. And I'm nervous about that side of it, too. Before giving you personal advice, Matt, which involves throwing your phone in the White River, I would say, which is where mine will go soon if this thing doesn't get cleared up today. If we look back at media history, you know, and we've had mass media in our world since the mid-1800s, when mass newspapers were invented. And then each new wave of media innovation that comes along, whether it was, film, movies, later television, radio, you know, and now social media, each one of those innovations, if you will, a technological innovation, has meant a time in which we've had to kind of learn about the great things we can do with that medium, as well as the very bad things that can happen with that medium. And generationally, we kind of have to learn that lesson. And I think we're probably still in a point with social media where it is, you know, this is a tough lesson for us to learn. To learn that just because it's on Facebook and it looks like a video, you know, that's real, doesn't mean that it is. Think of all your friends who share things on Facebook, and all you have to do is look on Snopes.com and show them that's not true. You know, well, there's a lot of people still doing that. So we kind of have to learn that lesson, I think, collectively, socially. And, you know, maybe you shouldn't throw your phone into the White River, but I would say that if we are judicious about our media consumption in ways that many of us are not, and I don't always practice what I preach as well. I don't think it's just social media, by the way. I wouldn't say that, you know, Facebook or Twitter are evil per se. And there's a lot of great things that happen there, wonderful things that can happen with human communication in those media. We all probably have stories of how we've reconnected with lost friends and loved ones and so forth. And that's wonderful. But, you know, we have an ecosystem where we really have to understand the flows back and forth, the level of vitriol and polarization that can happen in cable news, for instance, I think is really plays into the social media piece as well. And so if we look at our own media diet and say that there are things that are available to us that help us have access to much more than anyone would have had even 30 years ago, let's say. Newspapers still exist. They're even on paper, you know, which is how I like to read them. You can watch network television news that's still doing a very good job. You can listen to radio as we're doing now. And there are many, many different ways to get access to these kinds of information. So, of course, here, obviously, you know, at the media school, we're trying to educate students in all of that and educate the public as well. Expose yourself to more of it. And do less of it if it causes you anxiety to be exposed to these things on Twitter, let's say. Twitter can live without you for the next week and see how you feel then. You'll still know the information you need to know, very likely. You might even know it better or more of it if you're consuming it in a more information-based way.
Jim Shanahan, what do you think of the conversations happening right now around weather? Social media companies should label things as misinformation or delete things altogether. I've seen a lot of people on social media who are complaining about this and who are saying that they're going to leave Facebook and go to an unregulated platform like Gab, for instance. Yeah, what do you think of that?
Well, I think there's another one called Parler where conservatives were going, feeling that they were being shut out unfairly, you know, from some of the dominant social media platforms. I'm very conflicted about it in the following sense, which is probably for two or three reasons. My general approach would be to say, to fall on the free flow of information side and say, we all have to realize that there's going to be a ton of things on social media that are not true. Some will be true, and a lot of them will be in some gray area in between. And it's on us as consumers to figure out, you know, how to pull those apart, as I think it always is in the end. So that's, you know, one side of me. The other side of me wonders how many people will do that, you know? And if I would put myself in sort of the position of the nanny state administrator, you know, I'd say, I think we better, you know, work on providing these kinds of information for people, maybe giving them ratings and labels and things like that. How bad could that be? You know, I saw it, for instance, when we covered issues like anti-vaccination conspiracy theories, which are very prolific and, you know, very damaging. And so you started to see social media simply put up things like a red label that would say anti-vax, almost like your record album used to have like a parental warning on it, you know? and I thought, well, you know, I think in the end, we got to be pragmatic about things. So I think we're going to have, what it comes down to is if there's enough pressure on social media platforms to do this, be it from their users, be it from the political sphere and so forth, they will do some of it. I'll still have my concerns about free flow of information. But as you say, if Facebook does it, other places will emerge. My last concern is that how good would the social media be at really doing that? Because think of the volume of information that comes through those social media. And, you know, the idea, I've talked with colleagues here about whether they would have the ability to have automated tools, if you will, that could really be effective at sorting one out from the other. The answer is no, we're not there yet. Might be difficult to ever get there. So you have that issue. I think a last dimension of this is related to how big the social media platforms are. And, you know, we've gone through previous periods in media history when things had to be deregulated or monopolies had to be broken up and that kind of thing. And so with Facebook or Twitter being such huge players in the social media sphere, YouTube as well, and a few others, I think, you know, there's that issue as well. I don't see an easy solution to it, but ultimately, if somebody's listening to this show, I think it means they're interested enough to know that they can take charge of their own social media use, A, by limiting it to a reasonable extent, and then B, fact-checking on their own. Many great fact-checking resources, by the way, are easily available.
We're talking with Jim Shanahan, co-author of a recent study on tracking theories around the 2020 election on social media, conspiracy theories, that is. And we will be back with more from Jim Shanahan in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the 2020 election and its related conspiracy theories in mainstream politics. As always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and leave a question or comment there, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. And you can do that at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have with us, of course, Jim Shanahan, co-author of the study that we're covering today. And we left off talking about social media. So, Jim, what do you think about Twitter's recent actions on tweets from prominent politicians? And, of course, we can lump the president into that. Some of his tweets have been labeled by Twitter as misinformation. You can still view them, but you have to click through Twitter's messaging first. One Trump tweet from this afternoon, which reads, "Stop the fraud," in all caps, exclamation point, has this label over it: "Some or all of the content shared in this tweet is disputed and might be misleading about an election or other civic process." Are you surprised by the way that Twitter is handling this?
A little bit surprised, but not completely, because we've seen kind of a ramp up to that. And, you know, so like I said earlier, for me, my tendency would be to say, in a marketplace of information, just counter the bad ideas with the good ideas. That's the point of a free marketplace of information. I think it's really interesting and ironic that if we went back to the time before there was an internet, and it's going back before the lives of many of the listeners, but, you know, I do remember that time. And if we had said there's going to come a media ecosystem that will allow everyone to be a publisher with a potential mass audience, complete freedom to express themselves and their views, you know, I would have said, and many of others would have said, that is a future utopian paradise of information flow. And what we learned is that, you know, you can do good and bad things with information. And so, you know, my preference would be to have as little of that kind of thing as possible. But these are also high stakes. And so sometimes we find that our own ideology, you know, we have to be willing to temper that with a bit of pragmatism as well. And so I understand why, if we think about, for instance, just to, you know, connect it to the kinds of violence that can occur as a result of these types of things, for instance, whether it's protest violence or other things that happen when things are expressed in social media and people take that as, if you will, authorization to act in a certain way. If I were, you know, the guy sitting behind the control board at Twitter, thinking about that kind of responsibility, I'd think two and three and four times about it. So it is understandable there is the slippery slope that you worry about, which is, you know, who does the censorship, and where will that lead in a negative direction? It seems like right now the point is to get through this tough time, and
that
hopefully
might be, that might be a perfect segue into this listener voicemail from Lauren. She has a question. Let's listen to Lauren now.
Sure. Hi, my name is Lauren Curry. I'm calling from Indianapolis. I am wondering if you can talk about the intersection between conspiracy theory and radicalism or radicalization, and then further, how do those things intersect with class? Thank you so much.
Ooh, I like that other variable, that other factor that she threw in on how it intersects with class. Any help for Lauren?
Okay, so let's see. We got conspiracy theory and radicalization and class. Were those the three variables, Matt?
Yeah, that seems to be it.
Yeah, well, you know, again, I think it's helpful to look at some history, certainly for theories that historically came out of the right wing of American politics. They were often on the far right. So I'm sure that there was a reciprocal relationship, if you will, between being radicalized and being willing to express or believe conspiracy theories. They are then compelling narratives, which I think helps create a community around them. In previous years, you know, theories like, let's say, QAnon, there were earlier versions of QAnon. They weren't called that, obviously. They were different things. There's a long history of sort of a worldview that we might call a patriot worldview, you know, ideas of people prepping and living in the desert and things like that. And you could have heard those, let's say, in the 70s when I was growing up on shortwave radio, which is where I heard them, you know, sort of subaltern, you know, not mainstream media, alternative media that were difficult to get, but they were out there. And you would hear things, this is in my teenage years, that would curl your toes and make your hair stand up. And yes, there is a certain kind of radicalization going on and a message that one shares amongst each other that we know the secrets, we are sharing them with each other, and the sort of very pervasively difficult thing about conspiracies is that they already include the refutation to any evidence that that you or I might present. The refutation is that's just part of the conspiracy, right? So they're very resistant to evidence by nature, and you know, more evidence is often just taken as evidence of the idea that yeah, you're just doing this to continue your own conspiratorial acts. On the class side, yeah, I think we see that certainly for the far right conspiracies, there's definitely a class aspect to it. Yeah, of course, there's a class aspect to who's voting for President Trump in this election too, you know, so probably see a stronger kind of white working class subscription to those theories. It's easy enough for you to see if you're watching the news and they happen to show a QAnon rally or the candidates that were running with QAnon connections and so forth. I think, but, you know, we can look at a different conspiracy theory and find a different class there. If we look at some of the anti-vaccination ideas, completely different classes of people, you know, in some cases like Hollywood liberals and those kinds of people deciding not to vaccinate their children, usually for reasons that aren't very well founded. So, I mean, of course, class is a huge part of everything that happens in our life politically, socially, culturally. And these stories, I think, often are an expression, maybe not always, but often an expression of a distrust, usually of government, that will have a strong class basis to it. And so there's other conspiracy theories that would be more prevalent, you know, let's say in minority communities expressing that kind of government distrust. So, yeah, that's a great question.
We have another voicemail. This one's from Adam. He has a question about our current political climate. Let's listen.
Hi, Adam from New Harmony, Indiana. Child of the 90s and grew up with X-Files and alien autopsies and JFK conspiracies, and always found them to be entertaining. What's troubling about the conspiracy theories from you know, whether it's related to QAnon or Pizzagate lately, is they seem to have part and parcel to some sort of political agenda. I wondered what it is about today's climate that makes politics such a fertile ground for promoting conspiracy theories.
Right there with you, Adam. I had a lot of fun with conspiracy theories as a child of the 90s as well. But there didn't seem to be, Jim, this political twinge to some of those that I was susceptible with as a young, young uneducated man. Right. So, let's talk about that intersection a little bit.
Well,
is our climate just rife for it?
You know, I'm like you guys, not from the 90s, but from the 70s. And as I was explaining, I kind of grew up with the conspiracy theories that were available to me at that time. There is, I think, something of a surge of pleasure that you get from learning about stories that maybe nobody else knows about. And I'm, you know, initiated into that. I think, you know, bringing up X-Files and those kind of alien autopsy, even those weren't new. I remember a book from my childhood called Ancient Astronauts, which was the thesis that aliens came and kind of set up the world for us to be a species. You know, one hypothesis we could have is for that X-Files generation, and that was obviously, you know, a popular show and a great show, really fun, that, you know, that had some impact on how, you know, that entertainment does bleed over into how we think about other issues. So, you know, that's there. In my class, you know, we actually look at a range of conspiracy theories, some of which are really just fun. And, you know, the students know that if we're talking about Bigfoot or, you know, the Paul is dead conspiracy from the Beatles days, those kinds of things, that it's, and even aliens, you know, is probably all about fun, and they're fun stories, like I said. But when we get over into the side of anti-vaccine conspiracy or climate denialism, or now the political ones that we're talking about, there are real impacts to that. The caller calling all the way down from New Harmony, I think, you know, was saying, asking what's different about this climate, if you will. And I think, you know, we could look at, you know, sociological considerations. The climate, the two factors that I would identify as being most prominent are the fact that we are all now have this ability to be very, very frequent social media users. So the volume of that and the facility with it, and the fact that some people really live their life on social media almost. You just picture the person who's always looking at their phone and swiping through it, and that's where their life is. So, you know, that's kind of new. And then there's the factor of our political leadership encouraging that. And, of course, the polarization that we have, too. And, the polarization issue is that it is really not only possible but likely that, you know, Matt, if you're red and I'm blue, we can develop totally different media diets that sustain us, that make us happy, that give us pleasure. I can unfriend all the people that are making me mad, and you can do the same thing. It means we're unlikely to be exposed to the same kind of information in the way we might have been when, I don't know, you know, Walter Cronkite was giving everybody the news. So those are aspects of the climate that are different. But I think we can also come out of them if we approach it the right way.
I'm not so sure how much we want to delve into this, but I mean, is that a concern to you that we're all kind of retreating into, that some, rather, not all of us, are retreating into our respective echo chambers and even in some ways our own respective economies, I guess? Is that a concern?
Yeah. I remember reading a study a while ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, before social media had become so huge, saying that, you know, we know that if you go to, I'm going to make this up, but, you know, I go to Dunkin' Donuts and you go to Starbucks, you know, this tells me a lot about you two guys. I subscribe to Fly Fishing Magazine, you get Gun Weekly, you know, this tells me a lot about you guys. And so these kinds of polarization were really starting, actually, we can go back to the 90s and see, you know, empirical and quantitative evidence of that. So that polarization was happening. The separate economies, I agree with you. I mean, like, just one story in this pandemic, and I'm here in Bloomington, but, you know, a lot of things closed off to us as far as recreation. So I've spent most weekends traveling around southern Indiana all the different, you know, rural towns around here to go out and go fishing and hiking and so forth. And, you know, you are exposed to some stark differences that are there that are urban, rural, red, blue, you know, people with college degrees, without college degrees and so forth. And we are in that, we are in a very polarized situation, probably across any dimension that you could look at. And I'm worried about it. As far as the media piece of it, you asked what you should do. For me, I say, if you're going to swim in, you know, if we're going to marinate in that sauce, you know, my echo chamber, marinate yourself in the other one too. And that's going to challenge some things that you believe to be inalterably true. You know, I can be watching, let's say, the cable news channel that is not my normal one. And I'm watching whatever issue they're talking about. And occasionally they'll say things and I'll go, well, that actually sounds like it could be real. Let me check that out. As opposed to if I had only exposed myself to, you know, the channel that I like. And I think the same could be said for NPR or anything. So I'll listen to right-wing radio. I'll listen to NPR. Same with newspapers. It's a lot, you know, to ask. And most people perhaps don't have that much time. But if we at least adopt the attitude that my most cherished ideologies could be wrong, I think that's a helpful attitude.
Do you think it's too early to quantify how much influence conspiracy theories had on the election?
Well, that's actually what we'll now look at in our as we wrap up our study. We'll have one more wave of data to go where we kind of do a post-election wrap-up. You know, just to give you a sense of the potential influence, we didn't get too much into the numbers, but, you know, like for the Biden story, we got about 45% of people expressing some degree of support for the idea that that's true. 45%. And think of the actual percentage vote that Trump is getting. I think last time I looked, it was like 48.5 or whatever. You know, there's pretty close numbers there. And a lot of these conspiracies fall in that range. And if we break it down by Republican versus Democrat, let's say, or people who specifically said, I'm voting for Trump versus Biden, the percentage is much higher. So maybe 75%, something like that, of the people who said, I'm going to vote for Trump, were also saying, yeah, I think Joe Biden has some cognitive issue. So that's a large percentage. I think, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to prove things causally. You could make the argument that they were already supporting Trump, and so now this narrative goes along with what they were already thinking. And it can be difficult to pull that apart. I tend to look at them as things that feed and sustain each other with just about anything in our political psychology, if you will. That's the, you know, the confirmation bias you talked about. It's the fact that ideologically, it's pretty unlikely for most kinds of people to change affiliation, you know, from one year to the next. There is a swing vote in there in the middle. But, you know, I would say the data that we're building up here didn't dissuade me that this was a really important topic to look at. And stay tuned for, you know, our reports in the next weeks or months as we kind of really pick that apart empirically and quantitatively.
Well, Jim Shanahan, I want to thank you for taking the time today. You're the co-author of the study that we've been covering. You're also the dean of the media school at Indiana University. Jim Shanahan, thanks for your work and thanks for your time today.
Okay, Matt, thanks for calling. And good luck, everyone. Looking forward to getting our election settled here today.
Hopefully we do that. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yasin. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our current engineer is Chris Flood. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. And tomorrow we have the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on the biggest Indiana news of the week and hear a few other stories we couldn't devote an entire hour to. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And download our all-in Vox Pop app wherever you get apps so you can get updates about the show and share high-quality voice messages, which we can put in front of our live panels. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.